As they began to experiment with multi-touch, they found that they could do all kinds of things that were both effective and fun. The new approach was useful for editing and retouching photographic images, for making drawings, and even for annotating spreadsheets and word processing documents. The more they worked with multi-touch, the more Orting and Christie believed they were onto something big. Having five different projects sprout up around similar technological possibilities wasn't unusual at Apple. Steve didn't issue a "Let there be the iPad" command one day and wake up the next to find the whole enterprise devoting itself to his single wish. Instead, the place was always bubbling with possibilities. His most important job was to sort through them and imagine how they could point the way to something entirely new. Steve had another critical decision to make during this period: how to treat the cancer that had been discovered in his pancreas. The fact that the islet cell neuroendocrine carcinoma was slow-growing and potentially treatable had given Lorene and him some hope. But the key word was potentially. Steve had always taken great care of his body in ways that may have seemed quirky to others, but that made sense to him. At one point in his younger days, he had been a fruitarian. He eventually settled into a vegetarian, primarily vegan, diet, as did Lorene, and he had no significant health problems. Now that he had a big one, he wanted to make sure for himself that the tumor was treated in the best way possible. In typical Jobsian fashion, that meant exploring all the alternatives. He started out talking to close advisors like Larry Brilliant, Andy Grove, Arthur Levinson, the Genentech CEO who was on Apple's board, and the physician author Dean Ornish. His Stanford doctors recommended immediate surgery to remove the tumor. In fact, the team of doctors included a surgeon who had pioneered a promising new surgical method for just this type of pancreatic cancer. But Steve wasn't immediately convinced that this was the best approach, so he told his doctors he first wanted to try something less invasive, namely treating it through his diet. There certainly seems to have been a psychological component to his decision to temporarily avoid surgery. Years later, according to his authorized biography, Steve told Walter Isaacson, "I really didn't want them to open up my body, so I tried to see if a few other things would work." It's natural to fear such an invasive operation, but for someone like Steve, who believed so strongly in the value of having control, it must have been especially complicated. But there were also intellectual reasons to investigate and try to understand his cancer. Steve's particular kind of tumor is a rare one. According to the National Cancer Institute, NCI, only about 1,000 cases a year are discovered in the United States. As a result, research on pancreatic islet cell neuroendocrine carcinomas is not buttressed by the kind of massive database available to doctors studying breast or lung cancer, to cite two more common forms, or even other forms of cancer of the pancreas. His own oncologist surgeon admitted to me privately that not enough was known at that time to determine statistically what the best treatment should be: surgery, chemotherapy, radiation therapy, something else, or a combination of treatments. So Steve's indecision about what to do was not completely off base. "I don't understand," says Brilliant, "how writers can portray him, on the one hand, as this tough-ass businessman, very materialistic with no mention of the spiritual side. But when it comes to his cancer, they claim that he had this crazy spiritual belief that he was in a messianic situation to heal it himself." Steve conducted his research with the same inquisitiveness he applied to understanding what would make a great new product. He scoured the globe for other options and made surreptitious trips to see doctors in Seattle, Baltimore, and Amsterdam. He was interested primarily in dietary treatments that might work and alternative cures that meshed more with his inclination toward an organic lifestyle. But he also talked to many expert mainstream doctors. At one point, he even convened a conference call where he was able to discuss his cancer with at least a half dozen of the best cancer doctors in the United States. But he found nothing that was more promising than surgery. The few people who knew intimately of Steve's cancer grew ever more exasperated as his research dragged on for months, and his doctor started to feel that the window for a successful operation that would get all the cancer was closing. Finally, in the summer of 2004, Steve acceded and checked into Stanford University Medical Center. On Saturday, July 31st, he spent most of the day on an operating table. The surgeons opened him up and removed the tumor. It was an extremely invasive surgery. Months later, Steve would show me his scar, a squarish semicircle nearly 2 feet long, starting at the bottom of one side of his rib cage, swooping down to his navel, and curving back up the other side. The pancreas is back behind your gastrointestinal organs, so the surgeons have to have enough room to pull some of them up and out of the way to get at it, he told me, gesturing with both hands as if he were doing it himself. They actually took only a small part of my pancreas, Steve continued. Just getting to it was the hard part. August 1st, the day after his marathon surgery, was a Sunday. Although he was still in the intensive care unit and more than a little logy from anesthesia and painkillers, he asked for his power book so he could put the finishing touches on a letter to Apple employees to inform them of his illness and surgery. In some ways, the letter was a marketing challenge. How can you put positive spin on the fact that you have had surgery to treat pancreatic cancer, a disease that in most cases is a death sentence? Here's what he wrote. Team, I have some personal news that I need to share with you, and I wanted you to hear it directly from me. This weekend, I underwent a successful surgery to remove a cancerous tumor from my pancreas. I had a very rare form of pancreatic cancer called an islet cell neuroendocrine tumor, which represents about 1% of the total cases of pancreatic cancer diagnosed each year, and can be cured by surgical removal if diagnosed in time. Mine was. I will not require any chemotherapy or radiation treatments. The far more common form of pancreatic cancer is called adenocarcinoma, which is currently not curable and usually carries a life expectancy of around 1 year after diagnosis. I mention this because when one hears pancreatic cancer, or Googles it, one immediately encounters this far more common and deadly form, which, thank God, is not what I had. I will be recuperating during the month of August and expect to return to work in September. While I'm out, I've asked Tim Cook to be responsible for Apple's day-to-day operations, so we shouldn't miss a beat. I'm sure I'll be calling some of you way too much in August, and I look forward to seeing you in September. Steve. P.S. I'm sending this from my hospital bed using my 17-inch PowerBook and an Airport Express. Knowing that the letter would probably wind up being made public, he had even made sure to get a plug-in for some Apple products. What he didn't reveal, and it is quite possible that he hadn't been told yet, was that when the surgeons opened him up, they also spotted some incipient cancerous metastases on Steve's liver. There is, of course, no way of knowing what would have happened to Steve if he hadn't delayed his surgery by 10 months. According to the National Cancer Institute, people who have Steve's kind of tumor entirely removed soon after an early diagnosis have a 55% chance of still being alive 5 years later. Steve would survive for 7 years, and those years would prove to be the most astounding and most productive of his life. Recovering from a radical abdominal surgery is hellish. A massive incision, like Steve's, generally guarantees a lengthy and difficult convalescence, mainly because so much soft tissue and muscle must heal without too much stress or stretching at a location where your body bends and flexes every time you sit or stand. As Steve tersely told me, the healing process really sucked. At first, he could hardly move without unleashing a cascade of pain radiating out from his gut all the way to the tips of his fingers and toes. When he finally got home from the 2-week hospital stay, it was all he could do to sit upright in a rocking chair. He didn't like his painkillers because they dulled his brain. Still, he was determined to get back to the office before the end of September. Many of us would react to a disease like Steve's by taking it slow at the office or by tackling a bucket list of things we've always wanted to do. Steve became even more focused on work. He was doing what he loved, recalls Lorene. If anything, he doubled down. So he spent much of that 7-week convalescence thinking deeply about Apple, the computer business, and the trajectory of digital technology. He assembled an ambitious to-do list of what he wanted to accomplish once he returned to the office. When he came back from that surgery, he was on a faster clock, remembers Tim Cook. The company is always running on a fast-moving treadmill that doesn't stop. But when he came back, there was an urgency about him. I recognized it immediately. The first thing Steve did was spend time with each member of the executive team, catching up on what was going on and explaining to each how he intended to approach his work going forward. He told them that he would now focus even more of his attention on things like product development, marketing, and the retail stores, and less attention on manufacturing, operations, finance, and human resources matters. He knew he had less stamina than before, although that wasn't easy to detect. Moreover, his doctors were keeping him on a short leash, he told them, insisting that he come in for regular checkups to make sure he was healing properly and monitoring for any other signs of cancer. He did not tell his senior staff that the cancer had likely spread, nor that he was going to have to endure rounds of chemotherapy. But he had come to accept that his business life would never again be like what it was, and he wanted them to know how that might change things at Apple. When he was done catching up, he turned his attention back to the big decision, which now seemed more urgent than ever. What would come next? Out of the 5 cell phone and tablet-related projects that had been percolating, only one was dead by the fall of 2004. Not surprisingly, the Wi-Fi team had failed to come up with anything of note. Motorola had inched ahead with its iTunes-ready rocker phone, but the handset was starting to look like what things designed by committee usually resemble, a turkey. For one thing, Motorola opted to build a chunky, so-called candy bar-style phone, which bore no resemblance whatsoever to its far more stylish forebears, the Razer flip phone and the iPod. The iTunes MP3's song files would be stored on removable micro SD flash memory cards, smaller, more fragile versions of the ones that had just begun to show up in most pocket digital cameras. Inexplicably, Motorola decided that those cards would accommodate no more than 100 songs, even though they could easily hold many times more. And despite the fact that the phone could provide internet access, you couldn't use it to buy and download music from the iTunes Music Store. Instead, any unlucky rocker buyer would have to use his computer to buy music via iTunes, and then transfer those tracks to the rocker via cable. This wasn't any improvement over the existing iPods, which, unlike the rocker, couldn't boast of having direct internet access. The more they learned about the rocker, the more Fidel and Apple's other star engineers dreaded the thing. Motorola would wind up taking 18 months to deliver it. During that same time, Apple would refresh its entire iPod product line twice. So it was no surprise that when Steve finally introduced the rocker at Apple's September 2005 Macworld, it was an afterthought. Apple's own sleek new compact iPod, called the Nano, was the star of the show. Fidel's music phone prototypes, which he worked on all through 2004, were far more interesting. His first version incorporated the iPod's distinctive thumbwheel interface as a sort of dialer. Steve liked Fidel's Moxie, but there was an obvious problem. The thumbwheel that worked so elegantly on the iPod turned out to be a serious hindrance on a music phone. While it was fine for scrolling through a list of music or contacts, thumb dial was awkward for actually dialing a new phone number. It was a gimmick. This prototype aimed too low with its technology and user interface design. Fidel's second prototype, which did away with the thumb wheel and put more emphasis on being a video player, showed great imagination and was a manifestation of Fidel's irrepressible ambition. It couldn't overcome an external problem. The cellular networks of that time weren't fast or reliable enough to provide consistent video streams. Even though Fidel's video phone could have been produced within a year with the right telecom partner, Steve chose not to go ahead. This prototype had aimed too high, since it depended upon cellular infrastructure that was not yet in place. The Project Purple team was running into a different set of problems. In their desire to repurpose and yet maintain compatibility with traditional Macintosh hardware and software, Project Purple's engineers were running into the bugaboos that Microsoft and the others had encountered with their tablet PCs: bulk, weight, battery life, and cost. Even a relatively small 10-inch screen would guzzle power and quickly exhaust the tablet's rechargeable batteries when operating untethered. Wi-Fi technology, which was the best means for connecting a mobile computer to the internet or to other computer networks, also sucked power, as did traditional PC microprocessors, even those tailored for laptops. The power demands of a tablet seemed like an intractable problem, given that existing batteries were big and heavy. So while the discrete technologies to build an iPad derived from Mac technology were coming together, the actual device you could make would be heavy and impractical, and would carry just about the same price tag as a conventional MacBook. Steve knew that would be a hard sell. Still, he didn't shudder the operation. Until he had a plan B, he wouldn't pull the plug on Purple. Greg Christie and Boss Ording, meanwhile, had spent several months in 2004 putting together and playing with a rather funky but working prototype of a multi-touch screen. The pair projected the live video image of a computer screen on a touch-sensitive surface the size of a conference room table. Using two hands, you could move folders around, activate icons, shrink and enlarge documents, and scroll around the screen horizontally and vertically with somewhat intuitive dexterity. The multi-touch gestures they had contrived to do all of this were rudimentary at this point. But Jumbotron, as design chief Johnny Ive eventually dubbed their prototype, was intriguing enough to offer a sense of how engaging it would be to control a touchscreen computer with your fingers. Ive, who had become a self-appointed scout for game-changing user interface technologies in Apple's own labs, had been following Christie and Ording's work all along and was mesmerized when he saw the Jumbotron demo in action. He wanted Steve to see this. He believed Apple could make multi-touch the basis of a new kind of device, and he believed it should be a tablet computer. Steve, too, had been thinking that Apple's next step would probably involve some kind of fundamental reconfiguration of the traditional personal computer. He had always been leaning toward making a tablet. That's why he gave the green light to Project Purple in the first place. But shortly after he returned from surgery, during one of their regular brainstorming walks around the Apple campus, Steve told Johnny Ive that he was beginning to think differently. "Steve wanted to shelve the project," Ive recalls. "I was so surprised because I was so excited about it." But one of the observations he made, and this is classically brilliant Steve, was that, "I don't know that I can convince people that a tablet is a product category that has real value. But I know that I can convince people they need a better phone." This suggestion wasn't made in glorious ignorance of the engineering it would require. He knew absolutely that building a phone was much, much harder than doing a tablet, because it had to be so small, and because it had to be a good phone and a good computer and a good music player. What he really wanted was to try to sell a whole new category of device. That, to him, was worth the risk. When Steve finally checked out the Jumbotron multi-touch demonstration prototype by Greg Christie and Boss Ording, he was completely underwhelmed, says Ive. He didn't see that there was any value to the idea. And I felt really stupid because I had perceived it to be a very big thing. I said, "Well, for example, imagine the back of a digital camera. Why would it have a small screen and all of those buttons? Why couldn't it be all display?" That was the first application that I could think of on the spot, which is a great example of just how early this was. Still, he was very, very dismissive. It was another example of one of those times when what he says and the way he says it is not personal. You could take it that way, but it wasn't. After mulling over multi-touch for a few days, however, Steve changed his mind. Perhaps multi-touch really was the user interface leap he had been looking for. He started to pick the brains of people he respected. He called Johnny to talk about it further. He conferred with Steve Sakoman, another former Newton and Palm engineer who now worked for Avi Tavanian as the VP of Software Technology, and who had been pushing for Apple to make the move into phones. And he wanted to hear what the iPod guys thought about multi-touch, since they'd already built the two music phone prototypes. He asked Tony Fadell to come check out the Jumbotron, since he had the hardware engineering expertise to judge what it might take to build such a technology into a much smaller device that could be mass-produced. Once he saw it, Fadell agreed that the technology was really interesting, but allowed that it wouldn't be easy to shrink that demo the size of a ping-pong table down to something functional that could fit into a pocket-sized device. So Steve gave him exactly that challenge. "You figured out how to blend music in a phone," he told Fadell. "Now go figure out how to add this multi-touch interface to the screen of a phone. A really cool, really small, really thin phone." In hindsight, it's clear that seeing Christy and Ording's multi-touch demo was an epiphany for Steve, one that was not all that different from his first visit to Xerox PARC 25 years earlier. Helping people interact more directly and intuitively with intelligent devices was the central factor in creating a new genre of smart mobile gadgets. The Mac had been a radical new conception of the user interface for a computer, and the iPod's thumb wheel had been a user interface breakthrough as well. Multitouch had the same potential as the Mac's GUI. But he'd have to move quickly. Thanks to the iPod, Steve knew that his team could strike fast. And also, because of the iPod experience, he knew that Apple could make mind-boggling quantities of whatever device it created. So he decided that Apple was going to create a cell phone. The company was going to put in the palm of your hand a gadget as slick and compact as an iPod that could download or play music and even video streamed directly over a wireless network, that would be a great phone with amazing voicemail and directory features, and that would be a computer as powerful as the engineering workstations he'd built at Next. Most people hated their cell phones, he liked to say. Apple would create one they would love. All this decision-making took place in late January 2005. It was hardly the only big thing going on at Apple. After all, at Macworld, Steve had unveiled the Mac Mini Computer, the iPod Shuffle, and a new suite of personal productivity applications called iWork, which he hoped would compete directly with Microsoft Office. But the cell phone project quickly became the main topic of discussion when he and Johnny met, as they did almost every day now. They would have lunch together 3 or 4 times a week and take long walks afterward, kicking around ideas for solving such mundane-sounding problems as how to keep a touchscreen from reacting to contact with your ear when you are talking on the phone, or which materials to use so that your screen wouldn't get all scuffed when sitting in your pocket alongside keys and loose change. Steve would sometimes go back to Johnny's design lab and sit there for hours, watching designers tinker with prototypes. Or else the two of them would stand together at the whiteboard, drawing and modifying each other's design ideas. They were two kindred spirits, and Steve would now collaborate more closely with Johnny than he ever had with Woz or Avi or Ruby or even Ed Catmull and John Lasseter. As he brainstormed with Johnny and as Fidel's team started to get going on a real design, Steve became increasingly confident. Creating a wholly new kind of mobile phone wouldn't be easy. In fact, it would turn out to be even more daunting than the original Macintosh project. But Steve was certain he could negotiate a good deal with a telephone company, now that he'd gained some experience from the Rocker deal. He felt sure that his team could master the software and engineering challenges. He began to have the sense that if it all panned out, this new gadget might be the biggest-selling electronic product of all time. It wasn't just going to be a phone, nor was it going to be a phone that was a media player. It was going to be a full-blown computer, too. That meant it would also be a smartphone, one that was perpetually connected to the Internet. The easiest part was coming up with a name for it. iPhone, of course. Chapter 13. Stanford. On the morning of June 16, 2005, Steve woke up with butterflies in his stomach. In fact, says Lorraine, I'd almost never seen him more nervous. Steve was a natural performer who elevated business presentations to something close to high art. But what made him fidgety this day was the prospect of addressing the Stanford University graduating class of 2005. University President John Hennessy had broached the idea several months earlier, and after taking just a little time to think it over, Steve had said yes. He was offered speaking engagements constantly, and he always said no. In fact, he was asked to do so many commencement addresses that it became a running joke with Lorraine and other friends who had college or graduate degrees. Steve said he'd accept one just to make an end run around them and get his PhD in a day, versus the years and years it had taken them. But in the end, saying no was simply a question of return on investment. Conferences and public speaking seemed to offer a meager payoff compared to other things, like a dazzling Macworld presentation, working on a great product, or being around his family. If you look closely at how he spent his time, says Tim Cook, you'll see that he hardly ever traveled, and he did none of the conferences and get-togethers that so many CEOs attend. He wanted to be home for dinner. Stanford was different. Even though speaking there would not turn Steve into Dr. Jobs, the school did not offer honorary degrees. For starters, he wouldn't have to travel or miss dinner, since it was possible for him to drive from his house to the university in just 7 minutes. More important, the university was deeply tied into the Silicon Valley tech community in a way he admired. Its education was first rate, and the professors he'd met through the years, like Jim Collins, were top caliber. Despite being a dropout, he always enjoyed spending time around smart college students. He was only going to do one commencement speech, says Lorraine, and if it was going to be anywhere, it was going to be at Stanford. Getting around to writing the speech proved to be something of a bother. Steve had talked to a few friends about what to say, and he had even asked the screenwriter Aaron Sorkin for some thoughts. But nothing came of all that, so finally he decided to write it himself. He wrote up a draft one night and then started bouncing ideas off Lorraine, Tim Cook, and a couple of others. He really wanted to get it right, says Lorraine. He wanted it to say something he really cared about. The language changed slightly, but its structure, which summed up his essential values in three vignettes, remained the same. In the days before the event, he would recite it while walking around the house, from the bedroom upstairs to the kitchen below. The kids watching their dad spring past them in the same kind of trance he'd sometimes enter in the days before Macworld or Apple's Worldwide Developers Conference. Several times he read it to the whole family at dinner. That Sunday morning, as the family got ready to leave for Stanford Stadium, Steve spent some time looking for his keys to the SUV, which he couldn't find anywhere. But then he decided he didn't want to drive anyway. He'd use the short ride to rehearse once more. By the time the family piled into the SUV, they were late. Lorraine drove as Steve tweaked the text yet again. Steve was sitting shotgun, with Aaron, Eve, and Reed piled into the back seat. As they made their way toward the campus, Steve and Lorraine fumbled through their pockets and Lorraine's handbag, looking for the VIP parking pass they'd been sent. They couldn't find it anywhere. As they neared Stanford, it became apparent that they should have built in more time. 23,000 people were descending on the stadium that morning. The stadium is usually easy to get to, since it sits just off El Camino Real. But many roads were blocked off to accommodate the heavy pedestrian traffic of graduates and their families. When they finally got into the eucalyptus grove on the outskirts of the campus that doubled as a parking lot for the stadium, Lorraine had to navigate around one roadblock after another. Steve was getting tense. He thought he might miss the only graduation speech he'd ever agreed to give. Finally, the family arrived at what seemed to be the last roadblock before the stadium. A policewoman standing by the sawhorse waved at Lorraine to stop. She walked slowly over to the driver's side of the car. "You can't go this way, ma'am," she said. "There's no parking here. You'll have to go back to Palo Alto High School, across El Camino. That's where the overflow lot is.
No, 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 Lorene said. We have a parking pass. We just lost it.
The policewoman stared at her.
You don't understand, Lorene explained. I have the commencement speaker here. He's right here in the car.
Really? The officer dipped her head and looked in through Lorene's window. She saw the three kids in the back, the elegant blonde driver, and a man in the shotgun seat wearing tattered jeans, Birkenstocks, and an old black T-shirt. He was fiddling with a few pieces of paper in his lap as he looked up at her through his rimless glasses. The officer stepped back and folded her arms.
Really? She said, raising her eyebrows. Which one?
Everyone in the car broke out laughing.
Really? Said Steve, raising his hand. It's me.
When they finally reached the stadium, Steve, who had donned a cap and gown, headed for the dais with President Hennessy, while Lorene and the kids accompanied his daughters to a luxury booth above the football field. The scene was the typical Stanford mix of solemnity and frivolity. Some students marched around dressed in wigs and speedos, participating in what's known as the wacky walk, while others simply sported the regular graduation gowns. A handful dressed up as iPods.
Hennessy spent a few minutes introducing Steve.
He spoke of Steve as a college dropout who, ironically, could serve as a model of the kind of broad thinking needed to change the world for the better. The students were thrilled with Hennessy's choice of commencement speaker. Steve seemed so much more accessible than the stuffed shirts who typically address graduating classes. After he tucked away his bottled water in a shelf under the speaker's podium, Steve launched into the 15-minute speech that would become the most quoted commencement address of all time. I am honored to be with you today at your commencement from one of the finest universities in the world. I never graduated from college. Truth be told, this is the closest I've ever gotten to a college graduation. Today, I want to tell you three stories from my life. That's it. No big deal. Just three stories. The first story is about connecting the dots. I dropped out of Reed College after the first 6 months, but then stayed around as a drop-in for another 18 months or so before I really quit. So why did I drop out? It started before I was born. My biological mother was a young, unwed college graduate student, and she decided to put me up for adoption. She felt very strongly that I should be adopted by college graduates, so everything was all set for me to be adopted at birth by a lawyer and his wife. Except that when I popped out, they decided at the last minute that they really wanted a girl. So my parents, who were on a waiting list, got a call in the middle of the night asking, "We have an unexpected baby boy. Do you want him?" They said, "Of course." My biological mother later found out that my mother had never graduated from college and that my father had never graduated from high school. She refused to sign the final adoption papers. She only relented a few months later when my parents promised that I would someday go to college. And 17 years later, I did go to college. But I naively chose a college that was almost as expensive as Stanford. And all of my working-class parents' savings were being spent on my college tuition. After 6 months, I couldn't see the value in it. I had no idea what I wanted to do with my life and no idea how college was going to help me figure it out. And here I was, spending all of the money my parents had saved their entire life. So I decided to drop out and trust that it would all work out okay. It was pretty scary at the time, but looking back, it was one of the best decisions I ever made. The minute I dropped out, I could stop taking the required classes that didn't interest me and begin dropping in on the ones that looked interesting. It wasn't all romantic. I didn't have a dorm room, so I slept on the floor in friends' rooms. I returned Coke bottles for the 5-cent deposits to buy food with. And I would walk the 7 miles across town every Sunday night to get one good meal a week at the Hare Krishna temple. I loved it. And much of what I stumbled into by following my curiosity and intuition turned out to be priceless later on.
Let me give you one example. Reed College, at that time, offered perhaps the best calligraphy instruction in the country. Throughout the campus, every poster, every label, and every drawer was beautifully hand-calligraphed. Because I had dropped out and didn't have to take the normal classes, I decided to take a calligraphy class to learn how to do this. I learned about serif and sans-serif typefaces, about varying the amount of space between different letter combinations, about what makes great typography great. It was beautiful, historical, artistically subtle in a way that science can't capture, and I found it fascinating. None of this had even a hope of any practical application in my life. But 10 years later, when we were designing the first Macintosh computer, it all came back to me. And we designed it all into the Mac. It was the first computer with beautiful typography. If I had never dropped in on that single course in college, the Mac would have never had multiple typefaces or proportionally spaced fonts. And since Windows just copied the Mac, it's likely that no personal computer would have them. If I had never dropped out, I would have never dropped in on this calligraphy class, and personal computers might not have the wonderful typography that they do. Of course, it was impossible to connect the dots looking forward when I was in college. But it was very, very clear looking backwards 10 years later. Again, you can't connect the dots looking forward. You can only connect them looking backwards. So you have to trust that the dots will somehow connect in your future. You have to trust in something. Your gut, destiny, life, karma, whatever. This approach has never let me down, and it has made all the difference in my life. My second story is about love and loss. I was lucky. I found what I loved to do early in life. Woz and I started Apple in my parents' garage when I was 20. We worked hard, and in 10 years, Apple had grown from just the two of us in a garage into a $2 billion company with over 4,000 employees. We had just released our finest creation, the Macintosh, a year earlier, and I had just turned 30. And then I got fired. How can you get fired from a company you started? Well, as Apple grew, we hired someone who I thought was very talented to run the company with me. And for the first year or so, things went well. But then our visions of the future began to diverge, and eventually we had a falling out. When we did, our board of directors sided with him. So at 30, I was out, and very publicly out. What had been the focus of my entire adult life was gone, and it was devastating. I really didn't know what to do for a few months. I felt that I had let the previous generation of entrepreneurs down, that I had dropped the baton as it was being passed to me. I met with David Packard and Bob Noyce and tried to apologize for screwing up so badly. I was a very public failure, and I even thought about running away from the valley. But something slowly began to dawn on me. I still loved what I did. The turn of events at Apple had not changed that, one bit. I had been rejected, but I was still in love. And so, I decided to start over. I didn't see it then, but it turned out that getting fired from Apple was the best thing that could have ever happened to me. The heaviness of being successful was replaced by the lightness of being a beginner again. Less sure about everything. It freed me to enter one of the most creative periods of my life. During the next 5 years, I started a company named Next, another company named Pixar, and fell in love with an amazing woman who would become my wife. Pixar went on to create the world's first computer-animated feature film, Toy Story, and is now the most successful animation studio in the world. In a remarkable turn of events, Apple bought Next, I returned to Apple, and the technology we developed at Next is at the heart of Apple's current renaissance. And Loreen and I have a wonderful family together. I'm pretty sure none of this would have happened if I hadn't been fired from Apple. It was awful tasting medicine. but I guess the patient needed it. Sometimes life hits you in the head with a brick. Don't lose faith. I'm convinced that the only thing that kept me going was that I loved what I did. You've got to find what you love. And that is as true for your work as it is for your lovers. Your work is going to fill a large part of your life, and the only way to be truly satisfied is to do what you believe is great work. And the only way to do great work is to love what you do. If you haven't found it yet, keep looking. Don't settle. As with all matters of the heart, you'll know when you find it. And like any great relationship, it just gets better and better as the years roll on. So keep looking until you find it. Don't settle. My third story is about death. When I was 17, I read a quote that went something like, "If you live each day as if it was your last, someday you'll most certainly be right." It made an impression on me. And since then, for the past 33 years, I have looked in the mirror every morning and asked myself, if today were the last day of my life, would I want to do what I am about to do today? And whenever the answer has been no for too many days in a row, I know I need to change something. Remembering that I'll be dead soon is the most important tool I've ever encountered to help me make the big choices in life. Because almost everything, all external expectations, all pride, all fear of embarrassment or failure, these things just fall away in the face of death, leaving only what is truly important. Remembering that you are going to die is the best way I know to avoid the trap of thinking you have something to lose. You are already naked. There is no reason not to follow your heart. About a year ago, I was diagnosed with cancer. I had a scan at 7:30 in the morning, and it clearly showed a tumor on my pancreas. I didn't even know what a pancreas was. The doctors told me this was almost certainly a type of cancer that is incurable, and that I should expect to live no longer than 3 to 6 months. My doctor advised me to go home and get my affairs in order, which is doctor's code for prepare to die. It means to try to tell your kids everything you thought you'd have the next 10 years to tell them in just a few months. It means to make sure everything is buttoned up so that it will be as easy as possible for your family. It means to say your goodbyes. I lived with that diagnosis all day. Later that evening, I had a biopsy, where they stuck an endoscope down my throat, through my stomach, and into my intestines, put a needle into my pancreas, and got a few cells from the tumor. I was sedated, but my wife, who was there, told me that when they viewed the cells under a microscope, the doctor started crying because it turned out to be a very rare form of pancreatic cancer that is curable with surgery. I had the surgery, and I'm fine now. This was the closest I've been to facing death, and I hope it's the closest I get for a few more decades. Having lived through it, I can now say this to you with a bit more certainty than when death was a useful but purely intellectual concept. No one wants to die. Even people who want to go to heaven don't want to die to get there. And yet, death is the destination we all share. No one has ever escaped it. And that is as it should be. Because death is very likely the single best invention of life. It is life's change agent. It clears out the old to make way for the new. Right now, the new is you. But someday not too long from now, you will gradually become the old and be cleared away. Sorry to be so dramatic, but it is quite true. Your time is limited, so don't waste it living someone else's life. Don't be trapped by dogma, which is living with the results of other people's thinking. Don't let the noise of others' opinions drown out your own inner voice. And most important, have the courage to follow your heart and intuition. They somehow already know what you truly want to become. Everything else is secondary. When I was young, there was an amazing publication called the Whole Earth Catalog, which was one of the Bibles of my generation. It was created by a fellow named Stuart Brand, not far from here in Menlo Park, and he brought it to life with his poetic touch. This was in the late 1960s, before personal computers and desktop publishing, so it was all made with typewriters, scissors, and Polaroid cameras. It was sort of like Google in paperback form. 35 years before Google came along. It was idealistic and overflowing with neat tools and great notions. Stuart and his team put out several issues of the Whole Earth Catalog, and then, when it had run its course, they put out a final issue. It was the mid-1970s, and I was your age. On the back cover of their final issue was a photograph of an early morning country road, the kind you might find yourself hitchhiking on if you were so adventurous. Beneath it were the words, "Stay hungry, stay foolish." It was their farewell message as they signed off. Stay hungry, stay foolish. And I have always wished that for myself. And now, as you graduate to begin anew, I wish that for you. Stay hungry, stay foolish. Thank you all very much. From his earliest days, Steve had always been able to spin a tale. But nothing he ever said before resonated this way. The speech has been viewed at least 35 million times on YouTube. It didn't go viral in the way of a web phenomenon of 2015. Social networks weren't as developed or extensive a decade ago. But it gradually became recognized as something truly exceptional, of great meaning to a world of people beyond the Stanford Stadium as well. Its popularity surprised him. None of us expected it to take off like that, says Katie Cotton, who headed up communications and PR for Apple at the time. It was not a speech that would have resonated or gotten the same attention a few years earlier. But by the summer of 2005, Apple was back, and Steve's reputation along with it. Revenues and profits were up, and the stock, too, was beginning to move in the right direction. All thoughts of the dark days, all memories of Spindler and Scully and Emilio had been banished, at least for the public. Steve himself always kept those times in the back of his mind as a reminder of what could happen if Apple didn't stay sharp. Much of the public found something deeply admirable about what he had accomplished. Steve was no longer a wunderkind, and he had put the has-been label to rest. Now he seemed to be a comeback hero, defying F. Scott Fitzgerald's adage that there are no second acts in American life. The question was no longer whether Apple would survive. The question was, what would Apple do next? Indeed, the cover story I had written for Fortune a few weeks before the speech was titled, "How Big Can Apple Get?" For Jim Collins, Apple's comeback is the starting point for considering the nature of Steve's greatness as a businessman. We all get crushed or decked or knocked down. Everyone does. Sometimes you may not even see that it's happened, but it happens to everyone, says Collins, who besides writing several bestsellers in the last 10 years has also turned himself into a world-class rock climber. Whenever I find myself tired, whenever I'm thinking about whether I want to launch into another creative project, I always think of Steve in that period when he was in trouble. I've always drawn sustenance from that. That's a touchstone for me, that willingness not to capitulate. Collins has specialized in the study of what makes great companies tick and what marks the people who lead them. He sees something unique in Steve's unorthodox business education. I used to call him the Beethoven of business, he says. But that's more true of when he was young. When Steve was 22, you could consider him a genius with 1,000 helpers. But he grew way beyond that. He's not a success story, but a growth story. It's truly remarkable to go from being a great artist to being a great company builder. After the scattered political and emotional frenzy of his first decade at Apple, and after his failure to deliver what he promised at Next, it was hard to imagine that Steve could ever be considered a great business leader. But by the summer of 2005, he had begun to seem just that. Clearly, Apple would have simply disappeared without him. Luck had played a big role in getting Steve back to Apple, but, says Collins, echoing Ed Catmull, what separates people is the return on luck, what you do with it when you get it. What matters is how you play the hand you're dealt. He continues, you don't leave the game until it's not your choice. Steve Jobs had great luck at arriving at the birth of an industry. Then he had bad luck in getting booted out. But Steve played whatever hand he was dealt to the best of his ability. Sometimes you create the hand by giving yourself challenges that will make you stronger when you don't even know what's next. That's the beauty of the story. Steve's almost like the Tom Hanks character in Castaway. Just keep breathing because you don't know what the tide will bring in tomorrow. The narrative that was created around Steve 1.0 has dominated, says Collins. That's partly because the story of a man who matured slowly into a seasoned leader is less interesting. Learning how to have disposable cash flow, and how to pick the right people, and growing and rounding off the sharp edges, and not merely acting strange, that's not as interesting. But all that personality stuff is just the packaging, the window dressing. What's the truth of your ambition? Do you have the humility to continually grow, to learn from your failures and get back up? Are you utterly relentless for your cause, ferocious for your cause? Can you channel your intensity and intelligence and energy and talents and gifts and ideas outward into something that is bigger and more impactful than you are? That's what great leadership is about. Part of what makes the Stanford speech so powerful is that it elucidates the very personal and hard-earned values Steve brought to his later leadership of Apple. Each of its three stories contains guidance that Steve could only really understand as a mature man. He was always glib, and he perhaps could have said these things as a younger man. But he wouldn't have really known what they meant. You have to trust that the dots will somehow connect in your future. The young Steve would have had none of this statement from the story about dropping out of Reed College. In the decade after founding Apple, Steve was hell-bent on shaping the future to his vision. He believed he could connect the dots as he moved forward. Time and again, his engineers found themselves hamstrung, trying to fit their work into his sometimes brilliant, sometimes misguided, specifications. That first time around at Apple, and again at Next, Steve had been convinced he could do just about everything better than the people working around him. But when he returned to Apple, he really did have to trust that the dots would somehow connect. Again and again during his second act, the specifics of Apple's next big things arose from unlikely sources. The iMac was concocted from the design of the eMate, a product that Steve killed. The iPod and iTunes were the direct result of Steve's misguided interest in movie editing software. Now Apple was developing a phone because five disparate teams knew that they had Steve's backing to explore widely, and their work had led him to decide against pursuing the product he really wanted to build, a tablet. Steve had grown comfortable with only seeing the connections between the dots after the fact. Maturity and the extraordinary talents of the team he had built made that possible. Sometimes life hits you in the head with a brick. Don't lose faith. The only way to do great work is to love what you do. If you haven't found it yet, keep looking. As with all matters of the heart, you'll know when you find it. And like any great relationship, it just gets better and better as the years roll on. Steve discovered what he loved to do early in his life. But what gave these words, from the second story in the speech, the section about love and loss, such power in 2005, was the fact that the love he had for his work had survived so much and resulted in so much. It took lots and lots of time. All those years of struggling at Next, of reconfiguring Pixar, of stabilizing Apple, for things to get better and better. Now he could speak with the confidence of someone who had worked on relationships, with Loreen, with the executive team at Apple, and even with his first daughter, Lisa. Steve's struggles and everything that he had learned as a result were essential to Apple's ability to again and again create products that people loved. No other huge company save Disney, perhaps, creates products that engender such emotional responses, even from otherwise skeptical journalists. After one product announcement, the New York Times ran a wrap-up story with the headline, "The Magic in Apple's Devices? The Heart." And this was 3 years after Steve's death. The company, like its boss, had many faults, but it worked with a sense of mission that was different from other companies in its industry. Have the courage to follow your heart and intuition. They somehow already know what you truly want to become. Without the proof of Apple's success, these words from the speech's final chapter could be misread as the kind of callow cheerleading intoned by high school valedictorians. But what gives them strength and power is that they come from someone who had proved their value in a corporate setting. Just as Steve thoroughly deviated from the norm, Apple deviated from the norm of its industry, and in many ways from all of corporate America. Steve had learned how to modulate the potential solipsism of follow your heart. Early in his career, intuition had meant a shuttered confidence in the inventions of his own brain. There was a stubborn refusal to consider the thoughts of others. By 2005, intuition had come to mean a sense of what to do that grew out of entertaining a world of possibilities. He was confident enough now to listen to his team as well as his own thoughts, and to acknowledge the nature of the world around him, as he had when learning about the movie industry at Pixar, or in evaluating the openings for Apple upon his return to the company, as he moved toward a course of action. Apple didn't steer toward the iPhone as a result of focus groups or market research. It headed that way because of intuition, but an intuition that was deeper and richer than the selfish preferences of the young man who had founded Apple. When I first read the speech online, I remembered an interview I'd conducted with Steve in 1998. We had been talking about the trajectory of his career when, in a rambling aside not unlike the road on the back cover of the last issue of the Whole Earth catalog, Steve told me about the impact that the catalog had had upon him. I think back to it when I'm trying to remind myself of what to do, of what's the right thing to do. A few weeks after that interview had been published in Fortune, I received an envelope in the mail. It was from Stuart Brand, and it contained a rare copy of that final issue. "Please give this to Steve next time you see him," Stuart asked. When I did, a week or two later, Steve was thrilled. He'd remembered the issue for all those years but had never had the time to locate a copy for himself. The end of the Stanford speech focuses on the catalog's back cover motto, "Stay hungry, stay foolish." But my favorite line about the catalog and Steve's speech is when he describes it as idealistic and overflowing with neat tools and great notions. This is, in fact, a lovely description of Steve's companies at their best. He was an empathetic man who wanted these graduates to head off on foolish, hungry pursuits, and who wanted to give them neat tools and great notions as they began their winding journey. Like Jim Collins, I had gotten close enough to Steve to see beyond his harshness and the occasional outright rudeness to the idealist within. Sometimes it was hard to convey this idealism to others, given Steve's intensity and unpredictably sharp elbows. The Stanford commencement speech gave the world a glimpse of that genuine idealism. Chapter 14. A Safe Haven for Pixar. On Saturday, March 12, 2005, Bob Iger, then president of the Walt Disney Company, picked up the phone to make a few calls from his home in Bel Air, California. He called his parents, his two grown daughters from his first marriage, and Daniel Burke and Thomas Murphy, his two most important professional mentors. Then he called someone he'd only met a couple of times, Steve Jobs. Iger had big news to share,
The following day, March 13th,